to, so such that the, we continue to that we have up to 15 hours of availability in a week for ECHO, but that the start date shall not be routinely earlier than 4 p.m. on school days.
I think there was a...
And then...
What the city attorney had mentioned, the language. I would just...
I got the effective date of the tie to the... I got the tie to the certificate of occupancy already on the meal program.
But I think there's a second one that you had that was just beyond an annual meeting, but a meeting that must occur before certificate of occupancy.
That should be a separate motion. Let's take care of this.
Right. It's a separate okay, that's a separate motion requested
no,
by...
No, I think he was adding that into the CUP, correct?
I think the council member's motion was to include the at least one language in the CUP.
Yes.
And then there'll be a separate motion later to direct the city manager to come back and tell you if that meeting hasn't occurred.
Right, but I want to make sure it's your language we're using.
She did read my language,
right.
And that'll be in the
Perfect.
Conditions of approval attached to the CUP.
Right.
And the language that I quoted with...
You're very good at legalese.
I was impressed by that.
I was taking notes. I was also in the language that I cited with regard to adding the requirement into the CUP for the neighborhood median is on page 19 in the management plan directly.
Yeah. I'll second.
Right. We have a motion.
Jim, your mic's on.
We have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Funk, a second by Council Member Newsom. Roll call, please.
Question in regards to this. Normally, we would read the ordinance title because of what we're doing. I'm assuming we
Please
still
go
need
right
to
ahead.
Do that.
Yes.
Is that correct?
After the vote, yes.
After the vote. Oh, very good. Thank you. Councilmember Borbeau.
Yes.
Councilmember Darris.
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk.
Yes.
Mayor Moreno.
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes 5-0. And the ordinance title reads, an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Atascadero, California, amending the Atascadero Municipal Code Title 9, Chapter 3, Article 23, Emergency Shelter Overlay Zone, and determining this ordinance is exempt from review under the California Environmental Quality Act. Emergency Shelter Overlay Zone Amendments, El Camino Homeless Organization, Amendment 24-0060 and ZCH 24-0061.
And Mayor, as to the conditional use permit, the City Council's action tonight is final. However, it's conditioned on the adoption after second reading of the ordinance, so it won't take effect until after second reading.
Yep. All right. And anything else that we need?
Well, I the second motion, I was just asking Ms. Lewis what the, there's no relation, by the way, for the public. what I was suggesting is where is an appropriate trigger that you move that the city manager work with ECHO to create a meaningful public engagement process to have further dialogue with the community prior to issuance of, I was asking about the building permit. They're submitting that pretty soon, so it's probably not enough time. So prior, Mr. Dunsmore, what would be a process that would give us 6 months out, perhaps, that we could trigger? Would that be a permit for a slab or a permit for, is there a point that I could have to know when to return to the council?
There is various stages of the construction permit that we could tie something to. It would go from grading, for example, then it would go to slab, then it would go to, well, in this case, I don't know if there's going to be framing because they're using sort of prefab construction. But it could be prior to, I don't think they're going to have roof nail shear on this. It's a
completion slab.
Could we stay within 6 months?
Just
of
say 6 months.
Of issuance of the building permit.
Of issuance of the building permit.
That would probably be the best case. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the construction phases for this project because it's a little different because the type of construction is different than conventional. So
yeah, so why don't we say, so I move that we ask the city manager to, actually, you say it, Jim.
I think the recommended motion would be to direct the city manager to work with ECHO and city staff on a meaningful public engagement process and report the results of said process within 6 months of the issuance of the building permit.
I'll move the language that the city manager just uttered.
I'll second.
Did Amanda get that?
Excellent. Well, we do have that on the recording, so.
Yeah.
All right. And I'm just going to look at Echo where that's manageable. Okay. And please, all of you, I know you will participate in that, be part of this, please.
Yes.
We want this to work. We do. So we've got a motion by Councilmember Bourbeau, a second by Mayor Pro Tem Funk. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau.
Yes.
Councilmember Darris.
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk.
Yes.
Mayor Moreno.
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes 5-0.
Thank you. We will take a break. I know many of you are here for other items, but thank you all who came, and we will continue this engagement. Take about a 7-ish minute break. We'll see you back.
Dave.
AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM, Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton. Tonight's city council meeting is in recess and will resume in just a short time. You're listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230 KPRL.
We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe.
Just about everyone knows the story of how Jackie Robinson first broke into the major leagues, ending decades of racially segregated play. But few recall how Robinson's career ended in 1956 as the Dodgers and Yankees were locked in a World Series rematch. Don Larsen had just pitched a perfect game, and that gave the Yankees a 3-2 series lead. Now Game 6, played at Brooklyn's Ebbets Field, and it was scoreless into the bottom of the 10th. Then the Dodgers mounted a rally, putting runners on first and second.
And of course the crowd senses this tremendous situation here.
There were two outs. Robinson Yankee pitcher Bob Turley was on the mound, and up to the plate stepped Jackie Robinson. Bob Wolf describes what happened next.
Here comes the pitch, and it comes in wide. And the count now is 1-1 to Jackie Robinson. Billy Martin ran over to second base, trying to bluff Gilliam back to the bag there, but there was no throw made. Slaughter's playing far back there in left field, and Mantle over in left center. Carey has moved over closer to the line, and Turley back off the mound for the moment. Now the right-hander's ready. The count is 1-1. Gilliam, hands on hips, leads off second base. A little further now. Turley looks back. Robinson waits. Here comes the pitch, and there goes a line drive to left field. Slaughter's after it. He leaps, it's over his head against the wall. Here comes Gilliam scoring. Brooklyn wins. Jackie Robinson is being pummeled by his teammates. Congratulated as he lined one out to left field. Slaughter leap for the ball. It was over his outstretched glove out up against that left field wall. Gilliam scored from second base. And the Brooklyn Dodgers win here in this home tent with a tremendous demonstration here as Jackie Robinson rose to the challenge. As you know, in the eighth inning, the same challenge, and he popped up, but this time after the intentional walk to Duke Snyder, Robinson came through, lacing one out to left field. Gilliam scored, and that's it in the ball game.
Jackie Robinson's clutch hit won the game 1-0 and tied the World Series 3 games apiece. The Yankees would go on to win Game 7, after which Jackie Robinson retired from baseball. His World Series game winner was the final hit of a great and heroic career.
Bye, be seated. Everybody say amen.
Amen.
Amen. Now, before we start, I got two announcements I want to read off to you. The deacons wish that whoever keeps writing, "Meet me in the basement," on the back of the hymn books would cut it out because everybody that goes down there tracks mud all over the church. Amen. And the deacons also wish that whoever keeps putting the frog in the baptismal pool would cut that out, because everybody's getting warts from it. Everybody say amen.
Amen.
Amen. Now, preacher went a-hunting. It was on a Sunday morning. Now, Coast was again his religion, but he took his gun along. He shot himself some very fine quail and one old measly hide. And then on his way returning home, he met a great big grizzly bear. Well, that bear marched out in the middle of the road, and he waltzed to the preacher, you see. Well, the preacher, he got so excited, he clumb a persimmon tree. Well, the bear, he sat down upon the ground, and the preacher climbed out on a limb. He cast his eyes to the God in the skies, and these words he says to him. Oh, Lord, didn't you deliver Daniel from the lion's den? Also deliver Jonah from the belly of the whale, and then the three Hebrew children from the fiery furnace, so the good book do declare. Well, oh Lord, if you can't help me, for goodness sakes, don't you help that bear.
Yeah!
Well, that preacher set up in that tree, some say that hit us all night. Along about daybreak, he says, oh Lord, if you don't help that bear, then you're gonna see one awful fight.
Uh-huh.
Well, just as he said it, the limb let go, and the preacher, he come floating down.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a sight to see him just before he hit the ground.
Uh-huh.
He struck old earth a cutting right and left. He did put up a pretty good fight.
Yeah.
Before he could do much, that bear grabbed him, squeezed him a little too tight.
Uh-huh.
Well, the preacher, he lost his hunting knife, but the bear held on with a vim.
Yeah.
So one more time, he cast his eyes to the God in the skies, and these words he says to him. Oh, Lord, didn't you deliver Daniel from the lion's den? Also deliver Jonah from the belly of the whale, and then the three Hebrew children from the fiery furnace, so the good book do declare. Well, oh, Lord, if you can't help me, for goodness sakes, don't you help that
of the moon I planted, but there came an early snow. There's been a hoot owl howling by my window now for 6 nights in a row.
AM 1230, KPRL, and 99.3 FM, Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton.
There we go. I was like, I can't even find my...
Hey, get the desk.
All right. So the council has just come back from a break, and we are going to move on to our second public hearing tonight, which is our CEQA Thresholds Ordinance. I will ask if there are any ex parte communications. To left, I am not seeing any.
None
for me either. Okay. Mr. Phil Dunsmore, Kelly Gleason, and Genevieve Sharrow. Actually, you're not Genevieve. That's not Genevieve. That's Dan.
Genevieve is online, though, with us.
Oh, Genevieve's
tonight.
Online. All right. Oh, there she is. Hey, Genevieve. Nice to
I'll
see you.
I'll go ahead and start.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. We're with you tonight with a discussion about CEQA streamlining, something we've been really excited to bring you. And right now we are joined by our consultant from MIG, Genevieve Sharrow, and our planning manager, or planning chief, as I would like to call it, Kelly. And we'll also be telling you about some of the standards that were being proposed for change in our zoning regulations. So take it away, Kelly, and we'll introduce Genevieve in a bit, too. Thank you.
Thank you. So this project has been a little time in the making. We did receive some grant funding for it, and so we're finally at the culmination. So a little bit of background. We did have our housing element adopted in 2020. The housing element looks at streamlining of permit processes associated with housing and other types of development in order to make housing development a lot more easy and streamlined and cost effective within jurisdictions. Again, we did receive a LEAP grant for this effort. So this effort, our consultants as well as some staff time was paid for through that grant. And really the focus is to reduce applicant time and costs and to provide clear upfront standards for development. So there are two types of processes that we generally work within. We have ministerial and discretionary actions. Ministerial actions mean that if you meet a certain defined set of standards, you can move forward just with a building permit. There's no neighborhood input, there's no additional staff review where we can make changes to your project. If you check all the boxes, you move forward. Discretionary projects are when CEQA is triggered. So if you come in for a use permit, for a use that requires a use permit or something else that triggers it, or if you don't check all of the ministerial boxes and are asking for some special exceptions, you go through a discretionary process, and that's where CEQA comes into play. Our current code has a very low and very simple trigger for CEQA, and a lot of this refers to our single-family home development on sloped properties. So what our code currently says is anytime you touch a slope of over 20%, you are now in a discretionary process. Staff does an environmental analysis through the CEQA process using a state checklist that is used. We analyze a lot of things such as native tree impacts. We also look at aesthetic impacts, archaeological impacts, impacts to cultural resources, water resources, things of that nature. The document takes a long time to prepare. There's a cost associated with that. And then there's also a cost that the state charges when we record and file those documents as we're required to by state law. There's not clear standards. Staff has the discretion to add mitigation measures to projects or conditions to projects. We as staff generally add a standard level of conditions and mitigation measures, and some of those have been incorporated into the standards you'll see tonight because they're generally what we do for projects going forward. So we have a couple different sections that we covered through the CEQA streamlining process. The first was hillside and grading development, so creating clear standards for those hillside development parcels. We also address watercourse and wetland adjacent projects. So what can you do within those areas directly adjacent to watercourses, creeks, wetland areas? We're also adding a formal section on historic resources, which is already covered by CEQA. But again, we're trying to streamline that process and bring it more back to a staff level approval with clear standards. And then archaeological resources is generally our fourth area where we have environmental impacts within the city. So hillside and grading standards are really, again, intended for those properties that have our single family home development on the west side, are generally on a lot of slope. Again, we have a current hillside grading policy. So this was never codified as an ordinance, but it did come before City Council many years ago, likely before all of you were on the council, and had some general parameters for how to develop on a slope. So we said, well, if you're on less than 30% slope, you can probably have your house as a pad on grade, you know, a concrete pad house foundation, and you might have a reasonable yard area associated with that. If you go greater than 30%, then you likely need to incorporate some stem walls and do sort of a stepped house. Maybe your yard area is not so much of a yard, it's more decking, and then that has lesser impact on the grading of the site. So we've taken some of those standards and ideas and incorporated them into our hillside grading standards as well. We also have our native tree ordinance, and we're not really proposing to make any changes to our native tree ordinance. The ordinance does allow for the removal of native trees that are associated with development when it can't be redesigned feasibly in any other way. There's mitigation fees associated with that, and in general, we don't see a lot of impacts to our native trees beyond what is needed for construction. Most people move to our west side area because they enjoy the tree canopy. I know Atascadero is a little cooler climate because of it. We all love the oak trees. Even if the standards are met with our current policies and our native tree ordinance, SEQA is still required. And so that's kind of what we're trying to get away from with the adoption of standards. So what we're doing with our standards is making our ministerial box bigger. So if you check all of the boxes, you just move forward with a building permit. So for building pads, slopes up to 20%, flat pad grading, typical slab on grade development, usually a little bit of cut or fill on a site and a graded slope around the house. Slopes over 20%, we get into the use of stem walls and stepped foundations, and that's typically what we see anyways, because it's a cheaper way sort of to develop on a slope than mass grading. We have some standards about that lowest finished floor height to make sure that we don't have a very large blank wall that neighbors might be looking at. And we've case study tested this against a couple houses on some very steep sites, about 45% slope, and they would have complied with the standards. So we're pretty comfortable that this is not an excessive standard. Yards, we're sort of tying to, we have to be very specific and they have to be objective standards, so we're tying to 50% of the building footprint or less to still give you a sort of flat yard area. This could even be done when stem walls are required, but it might be a yard area that is below the house or adjacent to the house on the side rather than as part of the house footprint. We have some standards on the maximum height of retaining walls and a separation if those walls need to be taller to allow for some landscaping in between to reduce any aesthetic impacts. For native tree removals, again, removals are mitigated through our tree ordinance, but right now we don't have sort of a number of how many trees you can take out before we might need to look a little bit closer at that development and make some changes and modifications. So our standards as proposed are tree removals less than 30% of the canopy area. Again, if you only have one or two trees, that's not going to be triggered. That's not very fair. But these are for larger tree sites, or 10,000 square feet, which is close to a quarter acre. But when we take into account driveways, building pad areas, and necessary slopes, that seems to be a reasonable amount of area. And then development area grading up to 12,500 square feet. And we're going to talk a little bit about that number. That number was changed with the Planning Commission recommendation from staff's recommendation. And so that would all be under a ministerial review, moving straight to building permit, no neighborhood notification. If you check all the boxes, you move forward. So as I mentioned, staff's original recommendation for the development area of grading before a precise plan process would be triggered, which has CEQA review, was 10,000 square feet originally. This is about a quarter acre of grading area on a site. It allows for a reasonable driveway. It tends to support projects that are a little bit closer to the street, so we don't do an extended driveway, and it tends to support projects that don't have large, expansive yard areas. This was recommended based on a couple previous projects that we had looked at. Planning Commission recommended that we increase that number slightly to 12,500 square feet. Phil's going to add some more to this discussion too, so I'll let him hop in.
Sorry about that. Thanks, Kelly. I want to add that I think in our staff report, we do recommend sticking to the 10,000 square foot. Since the publication of our staff report, however, we have gone out and done a lot of additional analysis. We've looked at a lot of the applications that have come in that fall in the precise plan category, and we have found that these numbers do get up there. They do get into 15, even 20,000 square foot of area very quickly because of the amount of grading it takes outside of the development pad, outside of the driveway area, and for the utilities and for leach fields and all of these things. So I think our position, as staff on this particular topic, is we might need a little more than 10,000 if we do want to dramatically reduce the amount of precise plans and CEQA analysis that we are performing, which is the overall goal of CEQA streamlining, is get projects out of that realm, give us more discretion as long as they follow these development standards. So that's all I wanted to add, because we've really tried to evaluate this very carefully to have a balance between not a lot of site disturbance, but also not a lot of CEQA.
So what was your concern about increasing it to the 12.5 that is now changed? Is it simply because you see it will affect more and we want to have a bigger impact on the streamlining? Or what was the concern in the first place then?
What we're seeing is that there's actually the amount of grading that's occurring on some of these applications that we have now is a lot more than we had originally anticipated. We once felt that 10,000 would remove a lot of the precise plan applications if they follow these standards, but we're now seeing it does probably need to be a little higher, and maybe 12,500 is about the right number, I suppose, is what we're seeing.
Okay. And when we chatted with the Planning Commission about this, you know, we did say at some point we're going to come back and check in, because our whole point is to reduce the number of precise plans. Also, most of our sites that are left in Atascadero that are vacant are the more difficult and more heavily sloped sites. And so sometimes that necessitates a longer driveway, because really the only place to put a house is a little bit farther into the site. So it's a number. 12,500 is currently in the ordinance as proposed, as was recommended from Planning Commission. And of course, we'll be back if it doesn't yield the results that we were looking for, because it is something that we're going to have to explore along the way as newer projects come in. And then there's always an option to go through the discretionary process. So we're not saying that somebody has to come in and they can only disturb a certain area or only take a certain number of trees out or only have retaining walls that are, you know, 5 feet tall. What we're saying is, if you check those boxes, straight to building permit. If you want to do something different, if you can't possibly design your site any differently, you still have an option to move forward. It just goes through the standard process that we're doing today. And so that still is an option for people who are looking to do a little bit different design or who have a very difficult site that they're trying to accommodate development on. And we're going to move over to watercourse and wetland adjacent development, and I think that Genevieve is going to take this one for you. And similar to the collector standards,
are homeowners are also be allowed. In downtown, trails down for dining and gathering spaces will also be allowed to in commercial and public owned properties to facilitate that river-oriented development. And that would allow for ministerial review. Go to the next slide. So projects that don't fit within that list of allowed items or improvements would go through the option two, the discretionary review process. So this would be for any other types of structures, sheds, anything that's not specifically called out for ministerial review. And then these projects would go through the same process, the discretionary review process, the precise planning process, and complete any CEQA review required. So in general, we intend to have a little extra oversight structures that can be placed in these creek-adjacent areas. They can be swept away by floods, cause damage downstream, cause greater flooding. So this alternative option for a discretionary review doesn't preclude any of that. It just allows for additional oversight and a mechanism really to add additional conditions for approval and anything CEQA mitigation measures. With regard to historic resources, of course, the city's rich history is reflected in the architecture around town. Currently, Title IX city zoning regulations allow the community development director to require a precise plan, that's a discretionary application, for any proposed development that could impact the historic resources. But there's not any standards for historic resources, for modifications, or a process to follow or any findings. Also, the city has no formal adopted list of historic resources other than the resources that are on the state and national register of historic places. But the city currently treats colony homes, other buildings that were built in that area or pre that area as historic resources consistent with state law. Staff uses the United States Secretary of Interior standards and guidance for modification and determines that a project remains a serial if you have and that's kind of our process, but nothing is codified on that. So the proposed historic ordinance would do a few things. First, it would adopt a generalized historic resources list, which includes colony homes in general, pre-colony era homes, and other historic resources that are already on the state and national registers. A more specific list could be developed later with more community involvement and participation in the development of that list. Second, the existing historic site zoning map overlay. There's a specific zoning overlay that exists and it applies now to certain historic properties and not others. So this is really just kind of cleanup item to propose applying that to just to those state and national register locations to kind of clean that up so that it's not applied to anything that's not listed on the state and national registers. And finally, the proposed standard, like the slide from our question, would establish that clear path forward for either the material or structure review for any modifications to a historic property. So this really codifies the city's current process, allowing projects that are compliant with Secretary of Interior standards to be processed without discretionary review, and those that do not comply require that alternative process and the discretionary review. Atascadero, in addition to historic resources, has a number of known areas of potential archaeological significance. Generally, these areas are areas of settlement for Native Americans, largely around fertile ground, creeks and natural springs, generally. These areas are potentially sensitive areas, so those would be exact locations are not released. But the city can maintain those locations for the purpose of protecting those resources. Currently, the city zoning code notes that if during the process of grading, excavating an archaeological resource is uncovered, the project will stop work and notify appropriate agencies. That still exists in the code. But in order to be a little bit more proactive, the proposed ordinance would have the city maintain that sensitive area map on file. And if a project is located within those areas, it can proceed with construction as long as it does a phase one study first to conclude that there's no impact to archaeological resources. If a phase one study would determine that there could be a potential environmental impact, then a site plan and related CEQA review would be required. I'll kick it back to Kelly for some recommendations.
Sure. So when the Planning Commission reviewed the item, they did recommend approval of the ordinances before you this evening. Also, that zoning map amendment, just to have that cleanup on the historic sites overlay zone, and adoption of a really generalized list of historic resources. So in order to sort of enact the ordinance for historic resources, we do have to have a list. The list today simply says colony era homes, and that's what we currently use today. That's what CEQA currently would look at for historic impacts. We do intend to do some outreach to property owners that have historic properties. So when we come back with a complete list, they will understand how that list might benefit them. For tax reasons and grant reasons and things of that nature for remodel. But today we're just recommending the adoption of a generalized list for those historic resources. Again, the discussion for the 10,000 to 12,500 square feet, that is a number that council can discuss if you would like. So the recommendation is to introduce for first reading the draft ordinance A, which amends Title IX to adopt the discretionary review thresholds and standards for hillsides, historic, archaeological resource, and watercourse adjacent areas. Also introduced for first reading by title only, draft ordinance B, which would be the modifications to the historic site overlay zone. Those would take off those minor properties from that and would only include properties that are on the state or national register. We would then go to second reading for the ordinance, and the ordinances would go into effect 30 days after second reading. And that does conclude our presentation. Staff and our consultant are available for any questions.
Thank you. I will look to council for any questions for staff. Councilmember Borba.
Oh, you good? Okay, all right, thank you. Very great presentation. A couple of questions for you. In regarding the hillside and grading portion of this, by not requiring or requiring less of these CEQA reviews and that sort of thing, I'm wondering how much staff time that's going to save you for project and how much money you think that's going to save people trying to build a single family home on a hillside.
So our CEQA documents right now, they're an initial study. They're multiple pages long. There's some information that can be boilerplate and some that can't. I think it takes us maybe between 10 and 15 hours to complete a CEQA document that then gets driven down to the county twice for posting and recordation. So saving us a lot of staff time in that realm. Our CEQA process costs about $2,400 for staff time, and then there's a state recording fee that's around $2,500. So those fees would be saved to the applicant.
Wow, more than $5,000 in a couple of days of staff time is a lot.
Yes.
There's also a lot of times with CEQA studies required that need to support findings. So we see, you know, the tribes recommending phase one on multiple projects, even if it's outside an archaeologically sensitive area and things of that nature. So in terms of consultant time and those kind of costs, it would save that as well.
That's great, and I think everybody should be happy with that, because that's a great thing that we're going through this process to save staff time and save people money. Speaking of the archaeological resources changes, in the staff report you mention about some concerns from the tribes. You mention trees, but I don't see any mention of that in the red lined language. So we're not doing that, right? We're not.
Correct. We believe that our existing ordinance and then the standards in place for how many trees you can remove on a property cover that concern.
Good. Okay, thank you. And then when you mentioned on the river or the watershed stuff, that made sense. That it's going to streamline for people. Even though we don't currently have any particular standard, this is going to clarify the standard and so allow people to ministerially proceed. But you mentioned, or Genevieve did, about sheds still requiring, and I thought sheds, you know, wow. Then I read the language here, you say, including structures that are less than 120 square feet in size. So a very small shed would still trigger this? Do we just not want them? Because I can't imagine anybody then wanting to do it, given the price.
Yeah, we did have some discussions at Planning Commission about that. So things like a patio or, you know, something that doesn't have walls and it might be a gazebo, if it's within a floodplain or if the water levels rise, water can kind of wash over that. It's a little bit less of an investment. Those less than 120 square foot sheds, they seem like really small structures, but they're generally not tied down to the ground very well.
Right.
They also just create some challenges if they are swept away within that floodplain area. They've run into bridges. We saw that with our flooding. And so the buffer area is not a substantial area. And this is measured from, you know, the top of bank of the creek. Some of these are very sort of small rivulets and you're staying 20 feet away anyways. And so those structures, while they seem insignificant, actually create some issues when they are too close to moving water or potential moving water. And so we were recommending that those be maintained outside the buffer area.
Okay, so I'm just wondering if you consider just not allowing them in that area. Because, I mean, normally less than 120 square foot shed doesn't require any permitting whatsoever.
Does not require a permit, but is still required to meet setbacks in our code.
Okay. And regarding the list, the historical properties list, essentially we're defining them as going to be colony era, pre-colony era thing. But in the language of the ordinance, I guess, it still mentions the 50-year-old buildings that might have some, I don't know, significance or something unique about them, which is always sounds very odd to think that, I mean, that's something built in 1974. And one, I don't know who would consider that historic, but I want to make sure that I understand correctly how, whether those are included or not, because the language, they're still there in the
correct
language.
Yeah, so it's a little confusing because CEQA refers to the 50-year threshold. Secretary of Interior standards do as well, so we have to acknowledge that. But what we're trying to say is we, as a city, are declaring that our era of significance, our period of significance, is the colony era. It's the beginning of our community, and so that's what we're tying our standards to. But we want to also hold out there that if there was something very significant, let's say that was mid-century modern, built in, you know, 1948 or 1952, that we would still have that ability. But we're not saying that we're going to put those on a list. I think we're saying in general, you know, there are structures that may fall into a historic category at some point in time, 20 years from now. But as we come back, we'd like to come back actually with an adopted list. And as we do that, the intent is for the colony era structures in the city of Itasca.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. This great work on bringing this forward and the efficiencies that it offers in streamlining for folks. I will keep this very brief. The first is, how is distance from the river, the 100 feet from the river, measured in the areas of Salinas where you have a narrow channel, but maybe the riverbed itself is wide, and it's hard to say what the bank is?
We use the language, the high water mark, area of high water mark. So basically, it's the where you expect during flood conditions the high water mark to be. And what you're saying is correct. On some years, that can change. The Salinas River Basin is very wide. It's very large. And from time to time, those areas change. So it's not a perfect science. It is a 100-foot setback from that ordinary high water mark. What's ordinary? Well, right now, there is a sort of a standard boundary that we have mapped for where we believe that ordinary high water mark is. And a lot of it is actually just outside of the city limits anyway. And a lot of it has open space boundaries around it as well. So I think it's going to be easier than it may sound to measure those setbacks and for us to be able to have development standards that comply with it.
Sure. And fortunately, we had a fairly large flood event recently, so yeah, you can probably guess what was the high water mark you saw last January or before, in the big January event, and get that. Okay, the next is on the 12,500 versus 10,000 feet. We saw in the earlier item tonight a lot of anxiety from people who saw us making a change that they hadn't heard about and didn't, you know, nobody told me, you know, is the anxiety. And CEQA is mostly a process of notifying people. If we go with the 12,500 limit that the Planning Commission recommended, to what extent are we likely to open up ministerial review of projects that neighbors might, that likely would have attracted significant neighborhood comments and potential modification?
The good thing is about these proposed standards, they come along with a lot of really good mitigations about how to develop a site and not create significant impacts. That's what these grading standards are all about. So the hope is that we're not creating little disasters on these properties that do create frustrations or differences in the neighborhood, that they are compatible with the neighborhoods, that we do have a respectable threshold. That's what this is about, and we believe that's the right threshold based on our science, based on our analysis. If over time we need to adjust that number, we can come back and adjust it. But it looks like a lot of our precise plan applications that we're seeing now, the area of disturbance is a little bit near that or above that. So there are still, even with that number, some applications that you're not going to be able to avoid disturbing possibly 20,000 square feet, and unfortunately they're going to still end up in a CEQA process. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we just hope to at least cut that number in half.
Okay, so you know, it sounds like the risk is fairly low that we're going to open the door to a lot of stuff that we wish we would have had public input, neighbor input on. So, thank you.
All right. Councilmember Darris.
A couple questions. Well, since we're on the grading of 12,500 feet up from 10, how much discretion do we or you or the city or whoever has to increase that? At what point is CEQA going to go, you guys went too far? I mean, I'm not sure how we're coming up with 12,000 and why aren't we at 20 or whatever. I mean, I understand not that I'm suggesting that we go higher. I'm just wondering how we comfortably come up with the number, knowing that we're not violating any California laws or whatever.
Yeah, two parts to that question. Really, it's at the sort of the discretion and comfort level of council for our community. Again, CEQA is a public notification tool. There's no built-in mitigation measures. The state will never come and say that's too much for that or that's too much for that. There's a couple things that the state have some ideas on and guidance on. But in terms of grading or aesthetic impacts or impacts to trees, that is completely at the discretion of the local jurisdiction. And so what CEQA becomes in that way is a public notification tool. We have some precise plans that have an acre or more of disturbance on their property, and we do see a lot of neighborhood impacts associated with grading at that level, as you can imagine. Generally means they are on a very sloped site and need a lot of grading for a driveway and have a lot of impacts to the neighborhood. We do get a lot of neighborhood comment. We don't see a lot of ways to completely change people's plans sometimes, though. They invest a lot of money in their plans. We have slope sites, and there's certain driveway standards that you have to meet for safety and for the fire department. And so where we have some control are retaining walls, how those retaining walls look, some preservation of trees or replanting of the site when there's going to be aesthetic impacts. And so really it is, you know, at what level do we think we still need to have that sort of neighbor notification process and understanding of what those impacts are going to be to the neighborhood versus being able to go straight through with a building permit.
Okay, thanks. And then my next question is on the lamp and disturbance. Let's see, the water wastewater leach lines within 100 feet from creeks and 200 feet to wetlands and whatnot. I came across a project a couple years ago where the house was built, the owners wanted to add an apartment or something to that effect, and they were on septic already. Had this been an empty lot with no buildings on, never developed or anything, it would be completely unbuildable because the 100 foot, I think, killed it. 200 foot went across the street. So there was nothing. But So that was one thing. Like at least it was already developed. But the existing septic tank wasn't big enough to accommodate the added bedroom, Harvard's calculated. So we thought, well, we'll just, in the same location, remove the existing tank, put a bigger tank in, because we're not changing the location, even though it violates, say, new construction standards based on these numbers. But that wasn't even allowed. So how is something like, I mean, is that something that can be addressed or changed? Because it really changes the, upgrades of a house that's already been developed.
Yeah, it can't be addressed through this process because that is our LAMP, but maybe Mr. DeBar can weigh in on some of the options that the LAMP gives us when standards can't be met.
On it, thank you. And that's one of the reasons why the city pursued its own LAMP. It's basically our design standards for on-site wastewater treatment systems. So there's some other options that they could pursue. I mean, we allow some seepage pits, although you would not want that by a creek or a waterway. There's some other things too that are overarching on these, on the proposed code sections here. One is flood zones. Even though it says you can develop within, you can't develop within 20 feet of, that creek or that, lowest or highest watermark. There might be areas outside that 20 feet that are map floodplain that you cannot build in. And we have other regulations that overarch that. We also have stormwater requirements that if they, disturb under 12,500 square feet, they still need to meet, certain stormwater regulations. With regard to that LAMP, though, that septic, I mean, we do allow changing out of septic tanks. That's a pretty easy thing. I mean, we use our engineering judgment on a lot of these because otherwise it would deem that house inhabitable if you couldn't allow, if something is already wouldn't be permitted to today's standards. Right. Sometimes
I'm gonna interrupt us here since we're not sure. Talking about the LAMP tonight and the septic. We have a lot to go. Let's move on.
Thank you.
That's fine. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate
thank,
it.
Thank you, though. Any other things related to this item? Okay. So just to clarify with staff, if somebody wants to come in and they don't want to follow the